Good afternoon. Let us convene the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. For everybody's information, we are going to carry over under the, if you're looking at the agenda, the possible work session of House Bill 2191 to the next full meeting of this committee. And we're going to move now to the possible introduction of committee measures. I think most of you have in front of you LC Draft 2380, dated 11-19-10. Do I need to open a floor session? And I knew that, and I just was testing to see if Ben remembered. And I need to open up a work session on possible introduction of committee measures, which I've just done. Back to LC 2380.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 2380, dated November 19, 2010, be introduced as a committee bill.
Co-Chair Cannon has moved that LC 2380, dated 11-19-10, be introduced as a committee bill. And before I ask for discussion, I think it's always important this afternoon to say your assent to this being a committee bill does not at all reflect whether you are for or against the bill, just that we agree as a committee to take it under consideration. Is there any other discussion?
It does not indicate that you have even read the name, Bill.
In some cases.
Speaking only for myself.
So, with that said, I'd like the clerk to call the roll. At your convenience, we can call the roll. But we can't call the roll.
A more recent version, apparently, of the LC, dated 2311.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I withdraw the motion. And
Co-Chair Cannon withdraws the motion. I'd accept a new motion.
I will make a new motion. I move that LC 2380, dated February 3rd, 2011, be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Cannon has moved that LC Draft 2380, now dated 2311, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion on this?
I read this one.
That's an improvement.
I would only comment that as to the co-chair's earlier comment, mine that I did read is dated the proper date, and I knew that because I read it. So,
I'm sorry that comment had to come from my side of the aisle. And So, without any further discussion, now the clerk would call the roll, please.
Representative
Bailey?
Aye.
Representative
Benz? Aye.
Representative
Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Witt? Aye. Co-Vice Chair Boone? Excused. Co-Vice Chair Cruiser?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Gilliam?
Aye. The motion carries. The measure comes later. All right. Now we can get on to the business we... most of our guests are here for. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2873, and I'd like for Jed Jorgensen to come up first by himself, if he would, and then we'll, after this presentation, we'll proceed with more folks that want to testify. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming. I happen to know that you were perhaps in a better place yesterday, but we're glad to have you anyway.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, and Co-Chair, the rest of the co-chairs, co-vice chairs, and members of the committee and committee staff. I'm Jed Jorgensen with Energy Trust of Oregon, and I just flew back from Hawaii last night. That's what Co-Chair Gilliam was referring to. So I've done my best to pull this presentation together on short notice for all of you. But Energy Trust was asked by the committee staff to give a brief overview of in-conduit hydropower, to try to explain the fundamentals of what it is and why Energy Trust chooses to invest a portion of its funds into this resource. As the members of the committee know, Energy Trust is an independent nonprofit that is dedicated to helping Oregonians benefit from saving energy and tapping renewable resources. Our funds come from the ratepayers of Pacific Power, PGE, Northwest Natural, and Cascade Natural Gas, and we invest those funds in energy conservation projects and renewable energy projects that benefit those ratepayers. We are authorized by the legislature to help pay for the above-market costs of renewable energy resources that are less than 20 megawatts in capacity. And with regard to hydropower, those resources have to be outside of environmentally protected areas as defined by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. Although we don't use our resources at Energy Trust to influence political matters, we are glad to respond to questions about the potential effects of legislation on our programs, and it's in that capacity that I am here today. So what is an in-conduit hydropower project? Unfortunately, the answer, like a lot of what I do in my work, is more complicated than it would seemingly need to be. Hydropower projects are permitted at both federal and state levels, and the definition or term in-conduit comes from the federal definition that, or the federal permitting process that is overseen by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And in fact, the whole term is a conduit exemption, meaning an exemption from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's full licensing process. Essentially, the important thing is that the energy that would be generated is being made with water that's going to be used for another purpose that's already going to be used, and it's in an existing man-made waterway or conveyance. And the way that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission defines project boundary is also important for your discussion of this bill, as the FERC looks at really just the powerhouse of the project. They don't look at the full extent of the man-made conveyance or the conduit or any transmission lines that might serve the project. It's just where the powerhouse of the project is located for the federal definition of a conduit exemption. Practically speaking, what does that mean? What we're looking at for the kinds of projects that would fall into this category are what we would call irrigation district canal pressurization projects. That's where a portion of an irrigation district canal is piped up rather than being an open canal. Those projects tend to range from about half a megawatt to 5 megawatts in scale here in Oregon, and the power from those is typically sold wholesale to a utility. These also include municipal pressure reduction valve replacement projects. Those are smaller projects where inside a municipal water line there's devices called pressure reduction valves that can that are there to dissipate the energy that builds up in the water so that it doesn't blow up our water heaters. And you can put a turbine in line with one of those devices and generate some energy. Those projects are a little bit smaller, typically 10 to 100 kilowatts in capacity. But they're also typically wholesaled to the utility because there's not often a load or energy use at those particular sites. The other place that you might typically see a conduit project is the patron using water from an irrigation ditch. If they have a pipe coming down their property that has a significant elevation potential, they may have a potential project. I call those ranch-scale projects. They're really the smallest of the bunch, 5 to 50 kilowatts in capacity, and those have the potential to be net metered, to directly offset the energy use of that at that potential at that site. So here's a picture of what we're talking about. This is the Swally Irrigation District in Central Oregon. They completed a conduit hydropower project just this last year, 750 kilowatts in size. It's a relatively small facility, as you can see, and this kind of, I think, may help to wrap your head around the scope of what we're talking about today. So why does Energy Trust care about these projects? In general, hydropower can be acquired more cost-effectively than many other renewable resources. The fuel is free. The projects can last a long time. Many hydropower projects last more than 50 years, and in-conduit projects in particular tend to have little or no environmental impact associated with them. They also bring all the other advantages that distributed generation projects bring. They increase the reliability of the electrical grid. They can be configured in some cases to match customer demand. They diversify the range of energy resources that we use, and they reduce the necessity of building new transmission lines or distribution lines or upgrading the existing ones that we have. These can also be very meaningful projects to at the local level. They help to diversify sources of income for the irrigation districts, municipalities, or ranches where they may be located. And they also mean local jobs for construction, operation, and maintenance. The other important thing is that the opportunities are almost ubiquitous in Oregon. I did a little bit of looking this morning at your district maps, and to my knowledge, actually, Representative Bailey may be the only member without the potential for an in-conduit project in their district. But that's only because we've already helped the city of Portland identify where their projects are, and they just happen to be in Northeast. But Co-Chair Gilliam, I actually was in your district a couple weeks ago helping to evaluate a potential project at a commercial nursery. Representative Cannon, there's a project in your district at Mount Tabor, actually. It's an in-conduit project of several megawatts in size there where the reservoirs are. Representative Witt has, we're actually working with City of Astoria near your district as well on a 30-kilowatt project at their municipal water system. Representative Bence, City of Baker City is also looking at an aquifer storage and recovery system that would count as an in-conduit project. And just north of your district, Representative Krieger, we helped the City of Coos Bay evaluate some potential in their municipal system.
Do you get reimbursed for mileage on this job?
I try to use a zip car. So we've done some other work to try to quantify what the resource is in Oregon. And we've done two studies in the last year to try to look at how much in-conduit hydropower might be available. And these are not complete for the whole state of Oregon, but they start to give a picture. One study looked specifically at irrigation water providers. One study looked specifically at ranch-scale projects in Wallowa County. Of the larger irrigation water providers, what we found is that if you're moving water across the state, you tend to have the potential somewhere on your system for a project. Again, this was not complete for the whole state, but we did a brief kind of scoping study overview of irrigation districts in some areas, and we found 29 potential sites with potentially just over 21 megawatts of capacity that we felt merit further feasibility work on the part of those irrigation districts. Looking at the ranch scale projects, a little bit hard to see. There's some triangles all over this map of Wallowa County here that are potential project sites coming off of different irrigation districts, or irrigation ditches, rather. What we found there was 22 ranch-scale projects totaling just over a megawatt of capacity. And these, the majority of, would be net metered and would help offset the use at the actual ranches there. So that really concludes my overview of what these kind of projects are. I'm happy to answer any questions about what we do as Energy Trust with respect to these projects or any other questions you might have.
Thank you. Representative Ken.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So I am interested in how the Oregon Energy Trust interfaces with these projects. What, for example, what types of conditions must you follow when you decide which to support, which not to support? What does that support look like?
Mm-hmm.
A little more on that kind of financing of these would be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I included some additional slides just in case that was of interest. So I think this is going to address your questions, Co-Chair. What we offer sort of drives how we interface with the project. What we've found in our work is that the majority of the folks that have the potential for these projects don't necessarily have the experience or the resources to know how to develop them. They're not energy generators, first and foremost. They're water providers or municipalities or ranches. So what we do is we offer project development assistance that can really meet that potential customer where they are with whatever their experience is. If they need help with a feasibility study or with design of a project, working with the utility on interconnection, or for grant writing assistance to try to obtain other funds, we can be flexible to meet them wherever they need us to be and kind of help direct them through the project development pathways with respect to permitting and things like that. We cost share funds, typically 50% of a particular thing that needs to be done, a feasibility study, up to about $40,000 for a particular project. If it meets what our internal criteria are, that it's less than 20 megawatts, that it is capable of, it's either within the service territories of the utilities that we serve or can deliver power to those utilities, and it's not in an environmentally sensitive area, and it looks to be a reasonable project. We pay those grants as a reimbursement. And if a project appears to be ripe and has moved through the development processes and we have funds available, we can pay for what I called earlier the above market costs of a renewable resource. That's sort of a tricky definition, but what it essentially means is that we evaluate a project's finances to determine whether or not it's going to pay for itself with a reasonable rate of return. If it looks like it's going to fall short, we can, with the authorization of the legislature, fill in that gap. That's what the above market cost is, up to the level of our funding. We also do things to try to raise the level of expertise in the field, and with particular projects, we provide permitting assistance through these handbooks and guidebooks to the interconnection process with utilities, and that really kind of, we try to figure out where the market needs us to be and where we can fill in the gaps.
Thanks.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the federal government also is trying to incent these projects. As I understand it, the Bureau of Rec has asked that the Bureau projects identify in their irrigation systems locations where these small hydro units might fit. So it appears that there's a federal enthusiasm for these projects, just like the Energy Trust's enthusiasm. And I guess my question is there some time frame, time limit, something that should be, that we should be worried about when it comes to getting these things done? Is there a federal credit or some other good reason to try to move these things along?
Yeah, and with the federal credits, it's sort of a mishmash of different things that are available. The Bureau of Rec is doing some feasibility work, as you mentioned, looking at their particular waterways. They also offer Water Smart grants. Those are available just to irrigation districts, and those tend to come around once a year or so. Privately owned projects can take advantage of federal investment tax credit or a grant in lieu of that tax credit. That is set to expire at the end of this year, and a project, in order to take advantage of that, would need to get started by the end of this year. And that's a 30% tax credit, so it is significant.
Okay. Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Aside from the time pressure that's imposed by that permit, that credit expiration pressing upon us, there must be some other good reason for us trying to take advantage of these small hydro operations. I mean, the BUREC wouldn't be suggesting it, federal government wouldn't be enhancing it, you guys wouldn't be supporting it. So there must be, is there some reason we're trying to do this, or were those the reasons you gave us earlier, that is little or no environmental impact, I think you said, long-lasting, low-cost, diversified sources of power, all those are good reasons to try to move these projects along. And is there some sort of reason to do it more quickly than not? Or can we just do it whenever we get around to it?
That's a difficult question to answer, Representative. With respect to the renewable portfolio standards that the legislature has put in place for the utilities, there may or may not be reason to do hydropower projects in specific to that. Hydropower projects tend to be a more cost-effective opportunity than other renewables. Other than biomass, those two tend to be the most cost-effective at the small scale where Energy Trust operates. Again, under 20 megawatts, when you're getting larger than 20 megawatts, the project economics tend to change. And wind, of course, seems to be have some pretty good economics at this point. Our mandate from the legislature is to promote these projects and to go find them, and so that is the capacity in which I operate.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, if I missed this or didn't retain it in the first part of your presentation, give me a sense for how big small hydroelectric is in your portfolio, budget, et cetera.
Right now, I can tell you from Energy Trust perspective of our current budget, renewable resources make up about $14 million of our budget this year. That's split not evenly between the two utilities. We get more funds from PGE customers than we do from Pacific Core customers. The opportunities for hydro tend to be more on the Pacific Core side than in the PGE side, just based on where the resources are. So the funds are tighter in that sense. Within the Pacific Power budget, I believe there's about $1.5 million dedicated just to hydro in this year. Of that, you know, we're looking at a half a dozen projects that we would be about probably a dozen projects typically that we would help in feasibility work or moving along in the pipeline on a yearly basis, and then typically 2 to 3 to 4 projects that we might find an incentive for in a given year. And again, those are going to range from anywhere from 10 kilowatts in capacity up to 3 to 5 megawatts.
That's it. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
The projects you're describing are now mostly like on the ones you talked about, irrigation districts.
Mm-hmm.
How many other non-irrigation districts, like small farms and ranches, are you aware of in Oregon that micro-hydro sites that are in existence now? Do you have any idea of the number of them?
I really don't know the number of existing sites.
Well, I got the second exemption in 1984 for micro-hydro, so you need to come by and we'll visit.
Okay. That's great.
Other questions for Mr. Jorgensen? If not, we thank you. Mr. Jorgensen, if this is the way you throw together a proposal at the last minute, we look forward to a well-planned one.
Thank you.
Very much.
Appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, I'd like to move on with three other folks. If you could come up together, that would be great. I'd like to call Kevin Crew, David Philippi, and if Craig Reeder would come, we know you've come the farthest, I think, we'd appreciate it. So please all come up and identify yourself and for the record, and we'll begin.
Co-chairs, for the record, my name is Kevin Crew with BlackRock Consulting. I live in Bend and operate out of Bend in Deschutes County. Engineer, but I'm obviously technology illiterate, and Jed did a much better job than I did, and I had a little more time, I think, although I did weather the storm over the pass and had to cut a tree out of my driveway to get here.
Well, we appreciate it.
And it was important for me. I'm involved in this industry of water resources for irrigation districts and hydroelectric power generation projects. Especially with irrigation districts. So I thought I'd start here with a conduit-exempt hydro project example. This is, and Jed did a great job going through a lot of the things that I have here, so I can do these in short order. But this is an example of how these work. You pipe an existing canal that might have been around for 100 years, or pipe a section of it to capture elevation differential and the flow rate that comes down. And typically with the irrigation districts, they operate about 6 months out of the year. They start in a operation in April, typically, and then they end in October. And so that does limit the amount of generating capacity that you can get from these projects, and again, makes them a little bit more marginal because of that. So you pipe upstream, you capture the elevation differential and the water that comes down, you run it through a turbine, and then you put it back into the canal. So they're very simple projects and very clean, as you saw earlier. Associated with these projects...
Oh.
There we go. Associated with these projects, typically at a, say, a stream or river diversion, there will be a fish screen. And this is an example of a fish screen at Ochico Irrigation District. And then this is a what they call a horizontal flat plate screen that's, I believe, Farmers Irrigation District screen, just to give you an idea of what those look like. And, and their purpose is to pass the water and put the fish back into the river. This is an example of a fish ladder that Ochico Irrigation District worked on with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife just this last year. So again, at these diversion structures, typically there will be some kind of a check structure. The water is diverted out, and to move fish past these check structures and small dams, fish ladders are typically used to do that. This this exhibit is an example of some projects that went in Central Oregon. You can see down at the bottom of the exhibit where the blue river is. That's the Deschutes River, and these colored lines coming off of it are canals that meander, that were constructed approximately 100 years ago, and meander out into these irrigated areas. And you can see two boxes toward the top of the exhibit. One is Central Oregon Irrigation District's Juniper Ridge Hydro Project. The other is Swally's Hydro Project. You saw a picture of that earlier that Jed put up. And it just shows the, and then there's an arrow pointing to the north that says 43 miles to another project that North Unit is looking at. And again, the diversion starts off of the river. Irrigation districts have run these canals for 100 years, and now they're trying to tap into the energy downstream with the implementation of hydro projects. And this is a picture, again, of Swally's small hydro plant, 750 kilowatt plant. Again, they piped 5 miles of canal. And then they run water through a Francis turbine inside of there, and it produces 750 kilowatts peak during the summertime and through the irrigation season. And this is another example of a project called the Mora Drop Project, just to give you an idea of what the structures look like when they are complete. They're fairly concise. The interconnects are small. There's a little transformer sitting there. And this is a picture of Central Oregon Irrigation District's piping of their canal to produce 3.8 megawatts of hydropower. They piped 2.5 miles of canal over in Bend. The fall was 126 feet, so it's always been there. They just weren't tapping it. And so this is a steel conduit, and they convey water down through that and then run it through a Francis turbine to produce that power. They also associated with this project conserved 20 cubic feet per second of water, which is like having 7 fire hydrants opened up full bore, dumping back into the Deschutes River. That's how much seepage and percolation was lost in that section alone. And on Swally's project, they, I believe, put about 30 cubic feet per second back in stream on their project. And again, that would be like maybe another 10 fire hydrants running and putting that water back in the river. Again, this is I was the responsible party for preparing the study for the Energy Trust of Oregon that evaluated water rights across the state and then narrowed down to projects initially 1 megawatt or larger and then ultimately 0.5 megawatt or larger. And we found projects all around the state. If you lower that bar just a little bit, And you look at, say, 100 kilowatt projects and larger, you're going to add a significant number of projects. I can't tell you the number, but I can tell you that it would be at least 3 or 4 times the number of projects that would be 0.5 megawatt or larger. There's also been recently the addition of some small head hydro technology. There's technology called Natel. Sorry, I've jumped ahead here. Small head technology called Natel that's being introduced, and also kinetic hydro that takes advantage of just the velocity of the water itself in the irrigation canals that is being developed. They don't produce as much power because the energy equation is all about elevation differential and flow rate, but they do tap into that energy potential that's in those canals. Just in Central Oregon Irrigation District alone, there's 400 miles of open canals. So there's a lot of potential. There's 700 feet of fall between Bend and Redmond alone. So this is an example of a benefit-cost analysis of, it's actually pulled from a particular project. And you can see that at the bottom, the benefit-cost ratio is 1.01. And for my evaluation purposes, a value of 1 or better says that you have a project. But you can see how dollar-dependent these projects really are. And they really are. With, you know, the rates are tight. The cost of the projects, you know, have to be well managed to make these projects move forward. But given a project like Central Oregon Irrigation District Siphon Power Project that was put in 20 years ago, if you can wait the time, if you can get the benefit cost at one or better, and you can wait the time and then pay back your debt, then the project becomes very viable at that point. And so here is an example on North Unity Irrigation Districts of that untapped energy. And this low-head technology that's coming out with Kaplan turbines that have been around for a while and Natel technology, it's a great opportunity to tap these kinds of sources that are all along these canals in Oregon and generate power from them and put it right back onto the grid. So having said that, I think that there is a vast amount of untapped hydropower potential in Oregon. In the Energy Trust report, Jed showed you 29 sites in that table. I've evaluated just in the last 2 years another 18 sites. And with the advent of the kinetic energy technology that's being deployed right now and the low-head technology that's much more cost-effective than the traditional Kaplan turbines, there are a lot of projects that can happen. The difficulty that the irrigation districts have is that they're very small. Many of them are very remote. I heard discussion about Baker area. I met with the managers out there. There's one manager that rides the ditch, and then he runs the system and does the books and the whole thing. So these are the folks that have this potential. And the impediments that get stacked on top of these projects cause them to go away, or they just defer them for time. And so that's a real challenge. And I can tell you with what this bill, I think, will remedy is that these projects are using the same water and the same irrigation water rights that are already in existence that the irrigation districts have been using forever. And they're far, far away from the diversions. And all they're trying to do is use that water and that potential to create power and put it on the grid. If we add other hurdles or obstacles to these projects, many of them will go away, and likely most of them will go away. Thank you. And if you have any questions for me, if you want to wait for everyone, it's co-chairs.
I think we'll pause for a second in case anybody has a question.
I do. It's more of a comment, and I thank you very much for cutting that tree down and getting over here, because I think that's a good message for us to get. I've been working in the ocean energy and tidal energy sector for a while, about 5 years now, and the only ones I've heard of actually being in the water and irrigation dishes are in India, and it's a big deal over there, and it can be a big deal here in Oregon, too, so it's good news to hear that, because you're right, it's just there waiting to happen.
Yes, co-chairs and co-vice chair, in the Hydro Conference in Central Oregon, they mentioned that technology was being deployed in India. The folks were there that were presenting that. And those same folks would like to deploy some of that technology in the irrigation canals in Oregon and get some prototype projects out there. It looks very intriguing. But again, it's low power production. So if you immediately on a particular conduit exemption say, okay, in addition to that, you've got to go do this and that upstream 10 or 15 miles, it's not going to allow them to go forward.
Follow up. And I was going to ask you what device you're talking about, because I know there are a couple out there. Do you remember which one?
I don't remember. It was a floating kinetic machine that basically as the water, depending on the velocity of the water, spins the machine, has a generator there, and then they run the cables out to the machine, and then either supply directly to some use or put it on the grid.
Comes out of Alberta.
Yeah, but I can't remember the name.
It's Clayton Bear's company, and I can't remember it either. But, yeah, thank you.
Comment?
Yes, a comment. The predecessor of this committee, I don't think there are any members, but in 2007 visited the Swally project. The Energy and Environment Committee took a trip out there and saw the fish screen and the hydro on the pipe there. It's very impressive, and I think it does offer some sort of win-win-win possibilities. I wonder, you've alluded to these hydro projects being some distance from the diversion. My recollection in the Swally case is it's not that far. I'm not sure whether really matters, but I'm interested. You mentioned a couple of times the distance that these projects usually are. Why is that typically the case, that they're, you said, 10, 12 miles from the diversion?
Co-chair, the distance typically is so that the canal has distance so that it can drop. So if you start up here in Bend where the diversion for Swally is, and then you go down the 5 miles, you then have the 200 feet of fall to create the energy. So if you were up here closer, you wouldn't have as much fall. You wouldn't be able to produce as much energy. So typically that's why they're further away from the source. That's one thing. And then some of the systems are flat for a while, and then they drop. And so that's another reason that the projects are further away. But Swally's is 5 miles downstream of the diversion. And you bring up a good point. Swally has a compliance screen at the beginning of that, and a lot of districts do have compliance screens running the river. And there are programs that Fish and Wildlife has to help move those fish screening and passage projects forward apart from the adding that to a hydro water right.
Thanks.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we go back to your cost-benefit analysis? And I was looking to see if that 30 CFS that's put back in the river is given a cost and added up, or a value, a benefit. Do you get money back for putting that money back in the river?
Co-chairs and Representative Vance, this is actually not that project. This is a project on North Unit Irrigation District's canal. It's called the Brinson Drop, and it has not yet been implemented. But what's happening with the Central Oregon projects is, to the extent that there's seepage that they can measure in the canals, in the open basalt lava rock canals, they quantify that. They measure that ahead of time. They figure out what that loss is, and then through a water right transfer, they put that water back in stream. And there are interested parties, including the Bureau of Reclamation, Deschutes River Conservancy in that area, Upper Deschutes Watershed Council, and Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board are all parties that are very interested in getting that water conserved and putting it back in stream, as well as the Bureau of Reclamation. And so through those funding sources that are helpful in that process, they basically apply money to the piping portion of the project to help those projects move forward. The Juniper Ridge project that you saw, that steel conduit, that's a $26 million project, but without grants and other ERA funds and DRC contributions and other contributions, the project would not have made it. They're very price sensitive. But they also, that same project, conserved 20 CFS of water and in turn received some grant funding as a result of that. That brought interested parties to the table.
Thank you.
No other questions? We'll move on to our next witness.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Co-Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Cannon and other members of the committee. My name is David Filippi. I'm a partner with Stoll Reeves in Portland, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. I've been a member of the OWRC board for the past 12 years, since 1999. The Oregon Water Resources Congress is a trade association that represents irrigation districts, water control districts, and other water delivery organizations throughout Oregon. OWRC's members alone provide irrigation water to nearly 500,000 acres of irrigated land here in Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. House Bill 2873 provides that hydroelectric projects that are already exempted from federal regulation and located within existing artificial delivery systems will not be subject to additional requirements for fish screens, bypass devices, or fish passages if the projects themselves do not create changes in stream conditions that adversely affect fish. And I want to say from the outset that the Oregon Water Resources Congress in general and OWRC's members in particular are not anti-fish. We're not anti-fish passage or anything like that. To the contrary, the Congress has done yeoman's work to secure funding to implement fish screens or fish passage on many irrigation district diversions around the state. And most of the time, the monies that have been secured and made available are only cost share or matching dollars where the districts then have to pick up the balance of the costs of the passage or the screens. And So this bill is not intended to be anti-fish by any means. On the contrary, in our view, this bill is about how to best promote low-impact renewable energy projects, and in particular, the in-conduit projects we've been discussing, when, in our experience in trying to get these projects permitted, there's been an underlying tension between enabling the projects to go forward and then the tendency for state permitting authorities to condition the projects to require additional protections for fish, even if the project itself has little to no impact on fish to begin with. And so maybe if I could say it another way, and some of these points have been brought up, but I think it's good to summarize. This is what these projects are about. First, and fundamentally, they're renewable energy projects. Federal law and FERC encourage that these projects go forward, and they allow them to be cited under an exemption process. I'd also refer you to some additional testimony that's been, I think, submitted or will be submitted here shortly from Jan Lee. She is the executive director for the Northwest Hydro Association. She was unavailable to attend today in person, but her written comments helped to set forth and explain the exemption process. But first and fundamentally, that's why these are good projects, the renewable energy projects. Second, the water that's being used for these projects is already being diverted and delivered regardless of whether the in-conduit use projects go forward. So in the examples that you've seen of the Central Oregon and Suwalee projects, the water would be flowing through the ditch regardless of whether or not there was an in-conduit project that was added. Third, the projects for irrigation canals, they generate power when it's needed most, and that's during the summer irrigation season because that's when the water's flowing and that's when the power is generated. Fourth, and I want to underscore this point, these projects provide jobs, and they do it right away. The Central Oregon Irrigation District Juniper Ridge project that you've seen pictures of, it resulted in 115 jobs, good construction paying jobs for a year-long construction cycle, and that's according to Steve Johnson, the manager for Central Oregon Irrigation District, with whom I spoke earlier today. The fifth reason that I think these projects are terrific is that they do often put water back in stream for fish. And you've heard that about these two Central Oregon projects, between 40 and 50 cubic feet per second in the summer irrigation season has been left in stream below the North Canal Diversion Dam in Bend. That's water that would have been diverted into the ditches and would have been lost to seepage in the very porous basalt bottoms of those ditches. And the other great thing about that water that's being left in stream is that it's protected with a priority date. So it's off limits to downstream irrigators, so we know that that water is going to be there. And it's a huge step in the direction of trying to meet some of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's in-stream targets. And I guess the sixth reason that I would say that these projects are good projects is that they do generate a revenue stream that can be used for reinvestment in the infrastructure, including measures that help fish. Now, it was mentioned the COI project, for example. It was an expensive project, and the return on investment there is 16 years, and it's hard to put together an investment package where the return on investment is 16 years out. But I think the point here is that when you try to pile on additional costs, whether it's for fish passage or screens or other measures at the diversion, that's the tipping point that oftentimes will make many of these projects infeasible. So those are the good things and the reasons to do these projects. But what the project should not be treated as, in our view, is just another hook for the permitting authorities to require what is, in essence, mitigation when there's really no impact that's attributable to the small hydro project that would warrant the mitigation in the first place. And maybe just to put it in the form of a question, which is, I think, a terrific question for a policy discussion, is really at what point is the next marginal benefit for fish that's generated from adding on these requirements, at what point is that offset by the other benefits that these projects provide? We believe that this bill provides a better balance of the benefits than the current statute. Quite frankly, we believe that ODFW currently has discretion to both require fish improvements when they're warranted and to not require those improvements when they're not. But I think as a result of budget constraints and ODFW's mission, that oftentimes, or what we've seen, is that they exercise that discretion at every opportunity without really stepping back to look at the overall benefits. So in sum, I guess in conclusion, we would say that House Bill 2873 is intended to promote renewable energy projects that have little, if any, environmental impacts, and it avoids costly conditions that otherwise render a lot of these projects uneconomical. And with that, I'm happy to answer questions or turn it over to Mr. Reeder.
Any questions for Mr. Phillippe?
Thank you for your testimony.
Oh, sorry, Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would be delinquent if I didn't recognize Dave as a good friend of mine and one of the best water lawyers in the state. I'm very happy to see him here today. And I would like to ask you, and you may have said this, if ODFW is required by a current statutory framework to demand that, given this opportunity, more fish protective devices be placed at the 10 miles away from wherever this other thing might be going. Must they do what they're doing, or do they have that discretion? I think you mentioned, but I can't recall.
Co-chairs and Representative Bentz, thank you for your kind comments. And in response to your question, the provision at issue, the way that the conditions are attached is through the water right certificate. So currently the irrigation districts have a water right to divert water for irrigation purposes that stretches back oftentimes 100 years or more. In the process of getting the permits for the hydro project, the advocates have to approach the Water Resources Department and get a secondary authorization to use the same water but for an additional purpose. So as the water is traveling down the canal, instead of it just being for irrigation, now it's also for power authorization. And in the current statute is a provision that says that any new certificate that is issued for the secondary hydro use must contain the following conditions, and I'll quote that. It's fish screens, bypass devices, and fish passages as required by the State Department of Fish and Wildlife. We believe that language gives the department some discretion as to whether or not they require it in any given instance. In our experience, though, and in looking at some of the other statutes that help to direct the department as to when they should exercise that authority, we've had a friendly disagreement over how the statutes ought to be interpreted, and in our experience, we always end up with the conditions. And it's almost as if it's an anvil or a hammer that hangs over the heads of the projects that oftentimes tilts the economics in a negative fashion. So I believe they do have the discretion, but I've yet to see it exercised in a way that doesn't tack on requirements. And I guess the analogy I like to use is that these projects are a little bit like Christmas trees, and we can hang ornaments on the tree, but at some point, too many ornaments tip the tree over.
Thank you.
Representative, other questions? Thank you for your testimony, and we'll move on to Mr. Reed.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Reeder from Echo, Oregon. Thank you very much for the honor of speaking here today, and I very much appreciate letting us go towards the front of the list. I have a very, very important meeting that I have to get back to in Echo. I need to finish building the Harry Potter Lego castle with my son tonight, so I very, very much appreciate it because that's one I can't miss. And going through the list of why I would why I would be listened to here today, I think some of you have had potentially unfortunate or fortunate chance to visit with me earlier today in my capacity with one of our grower organizations that I'm very proud to represent. But also, I work for a large farming family in Eastern Oregon. I run and operate and for a hobby a fifth generation dryland wheat farm in Helix, Oregon. I'm a member of the Oregon Water Coalition, which is the 3369 project that we're just really excited to have the potential to work with, and also in run we're involved with six irrigation districts, and we run two of them. So in those capacities, we have a CAFO, we have some processing base, we have a lot of water rights. We were actually the first conserved water right for agriculture in the state. We completed that last year, and we're involved with recharge projects. So once a week, I either interact with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, with Water Resources, with ODA, or with the EQ, or with EPA. It's part of my daily routine in what we do. I'd like to underscore the fact that I believe that there is, while I'm going to talk today potentially critically of some of the current policies of some of the agencies, I think there's very much a huge need for them to help us to provide an accountability, a check and balance, and to help us implement best management practices and be good stewards of our resources. So I do want to underscore their importance and their need to help us do that. In this particular instance, I think it's really important as a person that's involved. We've been involved with several energy trust projects on implementing variable frequency drives for energy savings, and that's a wonderful incentive, and it's made us look at ways to be more efficient and get better through the energy trust. So we're involved with that, and we're looking at three solar projects right now. The transition of those are being underwritten by incentives, and I think it's really important that we need to incentivize the work on these, to continue to work on the renewable energy projects and remove barriers to the good projects. And I think that ODFNW has plenty of opportunity to help us be a good steward of these new projects, and this seems to me to be, you know, one more instance of them tacking on something that perhaps would be redundant or would be a barrier to a project that would otherwise be wonderful for the system. And we as producers, and something that's been fun, obviously growing up in Eastern Oregon, I grew up with a little bit of red on my neck, if you will, and since then have become familiar in my quest for summer withdrawals of water and making a living. I've become familiar with terms like carbon sequestration, net environmental benefit, and social responsibility. And I'm proud to say that not only have I added those to my vernacular, but I'm a true believer in them. And I can assure you that my generation of farmers and the groups that we're involved with and the people that we ask to participate, we want to do the right thing when it comes to fish, when it comes to our natural resources. And these projects like this, it's important that there's a new, in my opinion, there's a new tone with our generation of people who want to embrace those topics, you know, and implement things like mitigation strategies to flows. And also, when we're looking at these types of projects, there needs to be, you know, conditioning that is relevant to the impacts of the projects and not just blanketing conditions. The analogy that I'll use, and there are several specific examples I can provide, is it feels like a lot of times when we're trying to generate natural resource related projects, and which is, you know, which creates safe food, which sequesters carbon, which creates jobs, is analogous to a 55 mile an hour speed limit and a police officer. It's pretty effective. If you go 60, you're probably going to get a ticket. A lot of times when we're dealing with some of these agencies, we feel like that we're supposed to go 55, but we might have to go 53 because locally they think that's a better speed. And not only that, we're required to put a cost-restrictive speedometer in our car that logs our mileage every 15 seconds that we have to turn in on a monthly basis and have to randomly pull over to prove that we weren't exceeding the speed limit, instead of the already in place and effective checks and balances that we have with the agencies. So with that, I'd offer support to this bill. And again, I, if I can assure, you you know, from the people that I represent, that there is that we are embracing a broader range of natural resource use and stewardship than I think potentially has been seen in the past, and that's a commitment that I can personally give, and can assure you that if any of these projects there was a negative environmental benefit, that the group that I work with and I'm proud to represent would take care of the problem. And a lot of times it also becomes, you know, working with the agencies, we spend a lot on regulating our water rights and attorney's bills, and a lot of that money could be used elsewhere if we had more of a partnership type relationship. So that's kind of from the peanut gallery. But we do have a good attorney. It's just we spend a lot of money with them. So with that, I appreciate it. I don't know if there's any questions that you would have, but thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, and for taking time out of that other project. Any questions for Mr. Reeder?
Yes, sir. Sir, maybe this is back to Mr. Filippi. Isn't it the case that Oregon law historically requires fish passage on any stream that has a impediment? So isn't it the case, if we looked around the state, that where there is a impediment, fish passage has been required, and wouldn't this be a departure from that approach?
Co-Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Cannon, it's a good question. I wouldn't characterize it as that there is a hard and fast requirement for fish passage today. There is a policy that encourages fish passage to be installed, and actually in my materials, and I didn't want to go into all of the detail of the various statutes, but I actually addressed this within my testimony, and that is that there are certain triggering events where fish passage is required under current statute, and it's ORS 509-585, and those triggering events, it occurs when four key requirements are met. There must be construction, a fundamental change in permit status or abandonment of an artificial obstruction that crosses waters of the state where native migratory fish are or historically have been present. And in our view, this additional authorization for down canal hydro use, which is beyond the point of diversion, and I think that's you mentioned earlier, is you weren't sure what relevance that may have, and I think that's the key. If we're 5 miles, or in the case of North Unit, 50 miles down ditch or down canal from the diversion point, and there's nothing that's changing at the diversion point, the same water that enters that canal before and after the project, nothing changes. In our view, there is no trigger under existing law. Now, that's not to say that the Oregon Water Resources Congress doesn't get behind and support passage projects, because we have and we do, and we've sought funding for them. I think our point is simply that if nothing's changing at the diversion, why are we burdening these projects with a passage requirement when the in-conduit project downstream has nothing to do with whether or not fish currently can make it up and over a particular obstruction that sits in a waterway?
Just to be clear, the department has taken a different interpretation of the law, and that's why you brought forward the bill.
Co-Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Cannon, yes, that's correct. And I will say that in the immediate instance, with the two projects that you've seen, as well as the North Unit district, those are a number of very large districts, over 100,000 acres of irrigated agriculture in Central Oregon that come off of the North Canal Diversion Dam. We did negotiate a settlement where we had a difference of opinions as to whether or not passage ought to be required, and we came to a resolution, and the districts have agreed to cost share and to pay for some of that passage. That said, we are aware of many other projects across the state where we have very similar concerns, where we don't think that we're going to have the ability to negotiate some resolution, and it really comes down to, again, whether or not the in-conduit project should be a trigger, or whether or not, just as good policy, we ought to pursue it but not require it or hang it on the backs of these immediate projects today. Ultimately, we'd like to see these projects go forward when they don't have an additional impact on fish, in part because they generate the revenue then that the districts may not have available for 15 or 20 years, but it's then that revenue that they can reinvest in infrastructure improvements and the passage. So all of these districts, I didn't mention this before, but I'd underscore, they're nonprofits. I mean, they're not in the business of making money. They're quasi-municipal entities, so it's the only way that they raise money is through assessments, and that's really, I guess, the rub, is we see some of these projects in trouble.
Co-chairs, if I might add, that one of the projects that we're working on in the Umatilla Basin project, a lot of the districts are looking at recharge wells and ASR, aquifer storage and recovery projects. One of the things that we're working on, one of the really innovative people in our area that is dropping water down the hole and actually spinning the turbines backward when we're dropping water down the hole, which would potentially be an inline hydro project. And then that would mitigate the cost of having to lift the water twice to get down the hole to recharge and potentially reuse, and this would also potentially have some effect on that. And a lot of those diversions already have fish screens, and from the surface waters and the fish screens, I can tell you most of our fish screens in the area are very new and very sophisticated and have had biops and stuff around them too. So this also would potentially affect that and what Dave was talking about. Thank you.
Other questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to note that those of us who read the very long editorial comment by the Oregonian's editorial board over the weekend may have the conclusion that there will be other triggers, that Judge Redden may have a trigger or two of his own that he will be pulling, and the mere fact that we are diverting water out of our waterways may be problematic somewhere down the road. So it is incumbent upon us to do everything and anything that we possibly can to mitigate adverse impacts on salmonids, or we significantly risk a federal mandate, the likes of which I can virtually assure you none of us want to have to live under.
Thank all three of you for being here. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Someone's name has been screamed without being said, and I'd like to ask Kirk Melcher from ODFW to come up. We could, I just think this is a good part for you to come up and respond, and we may have you back up again before the hearing's over. Is that okay, Kirk?
I'm at your pleasure, okay. Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have some brief written comments here today, and then happy to answer any questions to the best of my ability. Briefly, and I won't recap what House Bill 2873 does. I think you understand that now. It is our understanding in reading the bill that it would still not exempt these facilities or these projects if they were, in fact, occurring at the point of diversion. So if there was construction activity at the point of diversion, those would not be exempted. It's strictly the in-conduit projects that are downstream from the point of diversion. I do want to say that fish passage and fish screening are critical resource issues for the department and for our constituents and for the fish that we're managing. We have a whole section on fish passage and fish screening in statute that details that out for us. Fish passage at artificial obstructions is very important for both resident species, so we maintain the connectivity of resident populations, and it's critical for our migratory populations, anadromous salmon and steelhead, so that we can fully utilize the productive potential of our watersheds. So fish passages is a very important resource issue for us. Fish screening is equally important. Fish screening, and that is the process of preventing fish, particularly juvenile fish, but also resident fish, from migrating down diversions, whether they be municipal, agricultural, or hydropower type diversions, and ending up in essentially in a dead end situation where they're either put through a turbine or out into a water delivery system. So both screening and passage are very, very important resource issues for us. Having said all that, and you've heard the earlier folks discuss triggering events. There's a number of triggering events that trigger fish passage and fish screening statutes. what is or is not a triggering event is really a public policy decision. It's something that this body has dealt with, legislature in the past. In 2007, in fact, House Bill 2785 was adopted, signed into law. That bill had a sizable amount of work done by constituents, agencies, and other folks in achieving the language that met people's needs. In House Bill 2785 in 2007, specifically fish passage and fish screening criteria were left in as something that were not exempted for these in-conduit hydro projects. And I would point out that this approach is really pretty consistent with our general fish passage and screening statutes, in that when we don't go out and require fish screening or fish passage be installed at a facility until there is a triggering event, which would be a major construction or a new relicensing, or in some cases, in this case, a new water right certificate. With that, I would point out that we're making incremental progress across the state. We've made great progress in removing barriers, not just artificial obstructions like this, but also in addressing impassable culverts and other man-made obstructions to fish passage. We're making great progress. It's incremental progress. These fish populations that we have across the state, and many have heard, they've suffered the death of 1,000 cuts. And as we fix these and place these bandages and repairs on, it's incremental, slow but incremental progress, and we're making good progress. Removing this as a triggering event would slow that progress a little bit. We would not have in conduit hydro as a triggering event. There still may be triggering events for those diversion structures. Those would be major construction or other activities. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
But there's Vice Chair Krieger.
On the type of projects that we saw here, the screens and newer ones, what percent of the smolts out of those systems do you think are getting into the projects? In other words, anadromous fish. I'm not talking about trout, but salmon, steelhead.
Sure. Chair Clem, Chair Cannon, Vice Chair Krieger. In that particular case, there are no anadromous fish in that reach of the Deschutes, so we're talking all resident fish. Most screens, though, have a very high efficiency on both anadromous and resident fish, and I would venture that it's in the upper 90 percentile. They're very effective at keeping juvenile fish out of the diversions.
In those diversions, you made the comment that they go down and they could go through a project, and I assume that you're talking about being killed at the project site, and if not, they go to the end of the project. Where are they being put out into a field, or are they going back into the river after going through the canal or pipe?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Krieger, it varies depending on the situation. But if it's an agricultural diversion, most of that water is not being returned to the system downstream. It may go through an in-conduit hydro and then later be delivered to customers, in which case, if a fish were to get into that canal, then yes, they would be going out through the agricultural delivery system. In the case where we have screened diversions, very, very little of that actually happens. And we have a good relationship, and we have a cost share program. We do work very well with landowners to develop and implement screening measures across the state.
Just a comment, because you were mentioning Judge Redden.
Yes.
You're talking a very small percentage of fish are being lost there. Yet we know cormorants are taking 50% of our smolts, not counting what Caspian terns are taking, which I've heard is 10 to 15%. Marine mammals take 4% of the adults, which I think is a low estimation. And we know that seals are taking probably 10 to 15% of smolts, at least in the coastal streams. So here we are worrying about 2 or 3% when the federal government is protecting the critters that are taking somewhere between 60 and 70%. It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? The very government that protects the predators puts the salmon on the endangered species list. I would say Judge Redden would be better off spending his time directing the Fish and Wildlife Service to control the number of predators.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and I'll be brief because I, too, actually have a Harry Potter Lego castle to build tonight, but I don't have children. That's just sad. It's a good time. My question is actually mirror Representative Krieger's questions. As the only representative here, I guess, without one of these projects in my district or the potential for one, I need to understand a little bit better what we're talking about here. So we've got fish in a waterway. We have an artificial diversion from that waterway for some sort of purpose, and we're talking about a project that's in the middle point of that artificial waterway. Is that correct?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey. So I want to clarify that there may be a point of diversion where the water is diverted from a given river, and then at some point away from that point of diversion, down either a canal or down a pipe, a delivery system, we're talking about installation of a hydro project. So it's not in the river proper, it's down the canal or down the pipe from the point of diversion.
Paul? So these aren't places then where fish would normally be, except in the case that they accidentally get down this pathway, is that correct?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, it depends on whether there's a screen involved. Many of these already have fish screens in place. For instance, the Central Oregon Irrigation District projects that we heard about here earlier, they had screens in place prior to the development of their in-conduit hydro. Not all ditches and diversions are currently screened. So some, if they're not currently screened and there's an in-conduit project that goes in down the line, then there's a higher probability that there would be fish not intended to be in the ditch, actually in the ditch or in the project.
Well,
please.
So you have these lost fish, essentially, in these areas. And this bill, as I understand it, would allow for a hydroelectric project to move forward without the additional requirements around fish screening unless there was a demonstration of adverse impacts on those fish. Is that correct?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, my read of the bill is that adverse impact has to be at the point of the adverse impact. So if there's a change to the actual structure where the diversion is occurring, then they would still have to address fish screening. If it's not a change to the structure, then they would not have to address fish screening requirements.
I'm sorry, clarification. I think you just said an adverse impact at the point of diversion. Do you mean at the point of diversion or at the point of the project?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, my read of the bill is at the point of diversion. It's at the point of diversion on the river. So if there's no change to the structure that causes the adverse impact, the original adverse impact, may have been 100 years ago, if there's no change to that structure, then there's no trigger to require screening of the diversion that occurs above that structure.
Final follow-up,
please, Chair.
And I think I'm asking Representative Krieger's question again, but I didn't quite understand the answer. So in the absence of the installation of one of these projects, you have lost fish coming down here if there is no screen. Where do they end up?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, again, it depends on the actual individual circumstances. They could end up flood irrigated out into a field. They could end up into a municipal water delivery system, which I would expect would have its own screening criteria, obviously, so that fish aren't going through the pipes, so to speak, or any other delivery system, whatever may be the end delivery point, that's where those fish would go.
You know, I'm sure I don't completely understand the use of the word trigger, but the way you describe it, it falls short for me of a triggering event. If nothing is changing, it doesn't, in my mind, and again, maybe it's semantics, but it doesn't, you don't have to comment on that, but
if this helps, you're welcome to say co-chairs.
Co-chair Camp.
Did you?
Vice Chair Krieger.
Kurt, in the game code, I read that once in a while, as you know. What is the responsibility of the Department of Fish and Wildlife to identify unscreened fish diversion points?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon,
whatever you
Co-Chair mean. Krieger, we are directed in the fish passage and fish screening sections to identify, prioritize. We have basically a statewide list of diversions, both screened and unscreened, and we have a statewide priority list that we use to direct funds to improve and implement those projects. So we do have that list. It's in our...
You know, your interaction, Will, I
gave you one question.
I just wanted to, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify, when you were talking about the possibilities for what Representative Bailey called lost fish, one of them might be that diversion returns, and I think you mentioned it in an earlier answer, but that diversion returns to the source stream, so that lost fish would actually have the opportunity to re-enter the natural waterway.
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, that is correct. I think in most cases, though, perhaps not all, but in most cases, these delivery systems are delivering water to customers and with very little that comes back, at least directly back. It may come back through groundwater seepage and other factors like that.
Okay. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that the conversation regarding the fish, whether they're better off with the device in the canal or not, is still bad news for the fish. But it's a triggering device. You're not focusing so much on it as for the purpose of the what's happening to the fish or not. It's a triggering device to put the screen at the front of the ditch. The question I have for you is this. The Energy Trust said that there is no doubt about the environmental benefit of the device. That's why they support it. And he gave us a long list of reasons why. You folks must have, because of the repetitive nature of this, a matrix or some other device where you can show us how you weigh and balance these things each time. It can't be just a subjective, knee-jerk sort of a thing, can it? You must have you can probably share with us that matrix that you use.
Get ready to get your knee jerked.
Co-chairs, Representative Benz, I think we certainly go through a matrix-like approach in terms of, are there fish present? Is it historically a fish-bearing stream? So that's a question that we ask. If there are fish present, then it's our interpretation has been that we need to either require fish passage or we have to request an exemption from the commission. Statute gives us the authority to exempt, and I'm not using the correct legal term, but basically to exempt diversions from providing fish passage and in the statute it says if there's a net benefit, we can show a net benefit from the project.
Oh,
please.
Okay, so that takes us right to this weighing and balancing that I'm suggesting would require some sort of format so folks can see it. So when they decide to put one of these projects in, they can say, you know, we've got to get by the ODF&W, and there's got to be some clarity in what we're going to have to do to get to the exemption you just suggested. Where do they find that?
Co-chairs, Representative Benz, off the top of my head, I don't know that we've been through that process with any of these in-conduit projects. We have been through it with some others, and I'd have to get back to you with that.
Thank you.
We're running out of time here, but maybe for a future hearing or just for the benefit of the committee, I'm interested in your department's policy or relationship to a separate issue, which you now enter into, which is renewables, particularly
renewable energy, particularly
small hydro. Do you all, maybe it's not within your mission statement, I don't know, but do you all have a policy as it relates to that area? Because your triggering events in your activity obviously has a huge impact on a completely different area than what we normally think you're charged with. So this, that interrelationship is really, I think, interesting to us. You can respond if you want.
Sure. Chair Gilliam, we don't have an agency-specific policy on renewables. We certainly come under the umbrella, and we're an executive branch agency. We work closely with the governor's office, and then, of course, with our statutes that that guide us in these policy matters.
All right. We got some more work or discussion to have on that. I want to give folks that are here a chance to testify before we have to move to the next bill, but we shall return. Is that all right with you?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'd like to ask Katie Fast and is that Kimberly? Kimberly Priestley and Jim Myron to come up, if they would. Thank you all for being here. As you can imagine, it's important at this stage that you not read testimony, not that you were planning to, but if you were, don't, and summarize and tell us, give us your best bullet points, and we'll be grateful. You can self-select. Who'd like to start?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, for the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'll try to be brief. I think you've had a good panel of experts who are involved in these projects day to day. Farm Bureau is in support of 2873. Many of our members are members of irrigation districts and are involved in seeing these projects move forward. We see the micro hydro in these hydro projects in line with several priorities of the state and with the legislature. First, these projects help meet the renewable portfolio standard that the state has set forward on. And in 2007, you've heard reference to legislation that was passed by the legislature. Actually, that was brought forward at the request of Oregon Farm Bureau and Oregon Water Resources Congress collectively. And it was brought forward to help water rights and these projects obtain a secondary authorization for hydro projects to existing water rights. And as you've heard from Mr. Melcher, the fish passage and fish screen language was left into that legislation as those secondary rights were moving forward. And that was done so because folks did not believe that these type of projects were a triggering point for fish passage needs and fish screening, because this is secondary to the main water right and the main purpose of the diversions. We still do not believe they're triggering points, but are supportive of this legislative fix moving forward. The second piece I'd like to touch on is that these projects are an important piece for water conservation. And it was mentioned by some of the earlier panel, but as canals that are open flowing streams that have issues with evaporation and seepage, as those are piped, it creates a great opportunity to take the pressure and the drops in many cases and put hydro in them and get a double benefit out of these irrigation projects to meet multi-purposes and multi-benefits of the state. And so in closing, because I know you're short on time, I just want to stress that we are not talking about changes to existing rights at the point of diversion. We're just talking about an additional benefit to these irrigation projects past the point of diversion, and that we're going to be continuing to utilize the same amount of water in those projects and using them for the main purpose of irrigation, not a main purpose of hydroelectricity. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. If there's no questions, we're going to move right along. Thank you.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, for the record, my name is Kimberly Priestley, and I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon. I'll try and keep this brief. As we have heard from the state, fish passage and fish screening have long been a priority for Oregonians. Water Watch opposes House Bill 2873 because it is inconsistent with existing law on both fish passage and fish screening. It also undermines the goals of the legislature with regard to hydropower development that is found in ORS 543, which basically says that there was a policy decision made that any and all hydro development would be done in a fish-friendly manner. Moreover, I would also like to point out a little bit of the history on House Bill 2873. We think that this bill is inconsistent with the agreements that were that enabled the original bill to move forward on in-conduit hydro in 2007. Before that bill, in-conduit hydro was allowed, but you had to go through all the processes of ORS 543, which we heard from the users were cumbersome and took a lot of time. And so in 2007, they introduced this bill that streamlined the process. Originally, Water Watch and the Hydropower Reform Coalition and others were opposed to this because we thought that it might end up in a sort of an end run around the existing provisions of the hydro statutes. There was a work group convened, and agreement was ultimately reached between Water Watch, the Water Resources Department, ODF&W, the Oregon Water Resources Congress, and the Farm Bureau. Key to that agreement from our perspective were a number of sideboards that attached to these projects, including measurement and reporting at the diversion site. This would be, you know, new if it's not existing, and also the fish and screening statutes. I mean, the fish and screening provisions. So again, we think that this bill undermines agreements that were made in good faith in 2007. I want to touch upon just a couple points made by Mr. Filippi. We agree that in-conduit hydro provides many benefits to Oregonians. We have renewable energy, jobs, an income source for the water right holder. I think the question before us today is, how are we going to achieve these benefits? Are we going to, you know, move forward with the state's goals of trying to getting fish passage and screening at otherwise, you know, at current obstructions that don't provide that, or are we going to do it in a way that sort of continues on with diversions that cause problems for our state's economically important fisheries? And there were just a couple points. There was a little bit of discussion about the discretion under the current statute. We agree that it gives ODF&W discretion. This bill will take away that discretion, and it will prohibit ODF&W from attaching fish screening and passage conditions if they feel the need to. As to the, you know, the comment that the experience has been that ODF&W just automatically applies these conditions. I'd like to remind the committee that there's only been two projects that have gone forward under the 2007 bill. And so I guess my point is this statute is still in its infancy, and I think it's premature to sort of lay this judgment on the state that they're automatically going to require this in every instance. I guess just finally, you know, we heard that this bill is not intended to be anti-fish, and, you know, we would argue that it is anti-fish. We think that the existing statute does a good job of providing balance to those who want to put in conduit hydro and, you know, gain all the benefits that go with that, and the ongoing priorities of the state to provide fish passage as we move forward into the future. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. One question?
Yeah, I don't know if you want to hear from the other panelists first. Or
sure, we can go ahead. Please.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jim Meyer, and I represent not only Water Watch but also the Native Fish Society. I just wanted to put the Native Fish Society on record as also opposing this bill for the same reasons that the Kimberly expressed. And to just give you a little historical perspective on this, I think I'm old enough to provide a little history on this one. I've been around doing these fish and water issues for 20 years here, and it's been a requirement in law, Oregon law, for decades that any passage barrier has to have a fish passage facility. Unfortunately, a lot of them were built without the passage facility, and the state did not do anything about it. When the Fish Passage Task Force was convened 11 or 12 years ago to try and sort through this and come up with a more workable mechanism, we all eventually ended up in agreement after about 6 or 8 months of beating up on each other. And one of the key sticking points was, what do you do with all the illegal ones out there now that are violating state law? Well, we decided that the state was going to ignore them, continue to ignore them, until such time as a triggering event occurred. And then it would get reviewed and determined whether or not Fish Passage was to be put in. Well, that triggering event is a decision for the Fish and Wildlife Commission. People can apply for a waiver, the Fish Passage Law. That decision goes to the Fish and Wildlife Commission under their existing authorities, and they either say yes or no. If they make a determination that your mitigation in lieu of passage provides a net benefit, and it's not just a net benefit, it's a net benefit for fish, pretty important distinction. But if it provides a net benefit for fish, then the commission will waive the fish passage requirement. We think the existing statutes should be utilized, and we see no reason to give folks an exemption from the fish passage and screening statutes just for in-conduit hydro. We think there's an expedited process for that. Let's use it.
Thank you. Co-chair Ken.
Yeah, no, I think Jim, thank you. I think Jim did a nice job of creating some of the historical context that's important for understanding your opposition to this. Because, Kimberly, I don't think you're making the claim that, I didn't hear you make the claim that one of these in-conduit projects creates additional adverse impacts for fish, right? But the history of this is, well, when we started requiring fish screens, we couldn't do that to all the existing diversions, right? So we instead adopted a sort of gradualist approach that when a water right holder applied for a change in that water right, then there would be a determination about moving forward with fish protections on that diversion. Am I correctly characterizing your response to this bill?
Yes, Co-Chair Cannon, that's exactly right.
Thank you.
Any other? Co-Chair Krieger.
Jim, I know you'd work with that, and Steve Barlin had been working on that issue. Do you remember off the top of your head a number of unscreened diversions that you were, when you started out, that you they were going to try to replace or fix or install?
Co-chairs, Representative Krieger, as I recall, the number at that time, and I don't know what it is currently, but at one point there was something like 3,500 unscreened diversions, and I don't recall what the number of barriers without fish passage was. It was a different number, a smaller number than that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow-up.
That was 12 years ago. It seemed like if we really want to take care of fish, that the state should be investing along with industry some type of a cost share or something that we could get in there and get and identify the most egregious ones that are actually taking fish and do something about it. This I realize that's a separate issue from what you're talking about, but you know, for 12 years, we've known about it, but what have we really done?
Co-chairs, Representative Krieger, all I can say is that the department has invested, I think, through OWEB, there's been about $4 million of biennium going into fish screening in the state. It's not enough, but it's certainly better than where we were 20 years ago.
Mr. Chair, it might be interesting to find out from the department what they think are the priorities, what's left to do, and whether or not any of the projects that we might think are coming are on those unscreened diversions.
Yeah, I'd like to know that too, and I'll bet you I get a nod from that from the department. Representative Witt and then Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question about Ms. Priestley's testimony. Do you have a copy of the bill with you there?
I do.
And I'm referring to Section 2, Sub 6A, Sub A, which would be on page 5. I think you, about the middle of the page, begins on line 20. and I think your testimony was that this bill would actually prohibit Fish and Wildlife from providing screening, even if they chose to do so.
Yes. Representative Witt, co-chairs, members of the committee, yes. My understanding of this bill is that unless there is a change at the point of diversion that adversely affects fish, they would not be allowed to condition the in-conduit hydro certificate to provide for fish passage and screening.
Mr. Chairman, this raises this to a higher order of concern for me. I had more or less read that as permissive, but I understand Ms. Priestley's interpretation, and it causes even greater concern for me. Thank you very much.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm still trying to wrap my head around this, and my comments, I think, dovetail off the previous three. It seems like we're having, I think part of the reason I'm getting confused, and with your leave, Mr. Chair, I might make a comment. I'm not sure this
Please.
Is a question. That I might be getting confused because I think we're talking about two different issues here and that they're linked together, and that what we're really having a debate about is the deployment and how best to deploy, incent, require, whatever verb you want to use, fish screens on points of diversion where they're not required by federal law, but that as proxy for that, we're also having a debate about whether or not these in-conduit hydro projects are the best way to go about making that happen, regardless of the merit of the individual project or its effect. And teasing those two things out as separate issues seems like perhaps a larger debate than this particular bill. So I would look forward to additional testimony about, I believe it was Representative Krieger's point about how many of these are out there, how big is the scope of the issue, what are the other options for doing this, and can we separate these two things out? My misunderstanding? I guess I'll just throw that open for anybody. That's the question.
No, I think that's helpful, Representative. Any other comments to the, in that regard?
I think that helps clarify what some of the testimony we've heard, but I have to say, as sitting here, I still, as important as the issue is, don't see the adverse or significant adverse harm to fish. So I think that we need to talk about this further. Co-chair and I will confer. But I do want to quickly ask Dennis Ritchie if he'll come forward. We have one more person that wanted to testify. And I'm sorry, Mr. Ritchie, but I sure can make it brief. We have one more bill to get up today. But thank you for coming.
Co-chairs Gilliam and Cannon, I'll make it short. I should say brief, probably. I am Dennis Ritchie, Oregon Anglers Executive Director, headquartered in West Lynn. Jim Myron actually let loose the 800-pound grill in the closet when he got right to the point. What has happened with fish screening is there have been lots of people, lots of property owners who either can't afford to or have chosen not to screen, even though the program is available. And this, in 2007, the agreement said if you trigger any changes in the use of that water, then you will come under the direction of ODFW as to whether or not you should put a screen in. And that's what the question is to you. Basically, should they have to screen when they have not screened before? I love the idea of the hydro power and the piping. I think it's wonderful. It's a great idea and it should be done. But I don't think the cost of a fish screen is going to break the project. But it may save the lives of a lot of fish. We've spent billions at this point on salmon recovery. And if we're worried about a few dollars here and there, I mean, we have to weigh and measure. Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Committee, if it's all right, I'll move on, and we will close the public hearing on 2873, and I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2876 and our lone, as far as I know, lone testifier is coming in. Senator, please. And just by way of introduction, this is our colleague, Senator Girod. And I just want to say on the record, Senator Girod, serving under you is just a measly half of your Senate district is one of the greatest honors I have in this building.
My introduction just got fouled up here. I'm going to say how hard it is to say co-chair Gilliam. I mean, that's just really kind of a hard thing.
Is this the same Senator Girod you were talking about?
And co-chair Cannon? I mean, I got the dynamic duo here. This is a tough committee to come before. But Senator Clem's bill.
Did you identify Senator Girod?
Oh, I need to introduce myself. It's very Girod. Senator Fred Girod. I represent Senate District 9. And kind of a brief overview of what that is, if you go from Shampooey Park to Mount Hood to the McKenzie Pass and then over to Paul's Lane County along the border there. I have 18 little cities, 3 rural counties. And more importantly, I have most of the Mullala, the Clackamas, the North and South Sennium watersheds. The history of this bill goes back about, well, actually, it goes back to the early 90s when I was here the first time. We had a problem on the river, and that problem is between, if you look at your bill, it's between Bennett Dam and where a ditch flows back into the river. What happens is there is the main stem of the river, and off of that you have kind of a loop, and that's called Gardner Ditch. And off of Gardner Ditch, above that, Salem takes their water supply out, Staten takes their water supply out, and the irrigation district takes their water supply out. The problem is in the main stem of the river, when in the summer, it gets relatively low, and it's fairly wide in that area. And so fish are extremely important in this district. And what happens is the water temperature rises, and it's a fish kill zone. So to make matters worse, on the Sanyam right now, two fish are listed as threatened, the salmon and the winter steelhead. So the importance of this river, just the water that you're drinking here probably comes from the North Sanyam River. And also, like I said, the city of Staten and the irrigation district. What we're worried about is what happened on the Klamath. What happened on the Klamath is there had to be minimum stream flows. That was a legal argument that was maintained by the courts, that there had to be a certain amount of water go down the river. This will throw all the water rights into compression, and it's going to be hard on Salem, it's going to be hard on Staten, and it's going to be hard on the irrigation district. There is a really simple fix to this, and those people that heard this bill last session, you passed it in the House. What it is between Bennett Dam and where the merger back with Gardner Ditch, if that area was to be deepened to the point where the water wouldn't heat up quite so much, then that wouldn't create a kill zone. So that's what this bill does. It calls for a study to see if that is a feasible way to treat it. Now, a lot of you are going to go, well, that's going to cost a lot of money. The thing is, in the 90s, when it was originally proposed and was ready to go, what happened, let me just say it was ready to go, and the cost of that was zero. And the reason the cost was zero is the aggregate in the river has such a value, and there's a sand and gravel company there, that for the value of the aggregate, they would have done the restoration. So last session, there was the fish groups came and testified in favor of it, and the city of Staten and the irrigation district gave testimony in favor of it. Brian would like to be here to give testimony for that, but he and I did a walkthrough as to the zone and what we that was given by the city of Staten and the irrigation district, and was kind of brought up to speed as to what the problem was in this area. So last session, this bill passed the House. I'm hoping that it passes the House again. We have a little better result in the Senate. It should be just a fairly the appropriation would be just for a study. And after that, I think that the cost would be rather minimal. That's pretty much it. Is there questions?
That's my job to ask if there's any questions.
Oh, sure.
I'm certainly not surprised that the problem was in the Senate, but I do appreciate you being here today. Are there any questions for the senator? Thank you for being here.
Okay,
we have two more folks that would like to testify on this bill. Again, Dennis Ritchie and Kurt Melcher, if you'd come up, and if you gentlemen can keep your comments, we are past the time we're supposed to be in this room, but let's keep going, and the committee will bear with me. Could you try to do it in 3 minutes? I'd really appreciate it. Each. Pretty generous.
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'll be brief. You all have written comments as well. We have reviewed House Bill 2876. We want to make you aware there's a number of current studies underway already in the Santiam and the North Santiam Basin, both by the federal agencies, National Marine Fisheries Service, as well as by the Santiam Water Control District. We would want to make sure that any direction you provide us with regard to this bill, with regard to conducting this study, does not require us to be duplicative of those efforts that are already underway. I do expect, I don't have a fiscal impact statement on this bill yet, I do expect there will be some costs associated with a study depending on how broad the scope of that study is. But with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions. And you have a little bit more detailed written comments. I understand you're in a hurry to get out of here. And
well, we are.
Although traffic, I hear, is a mess on I-5 North. So
well, let's just relax.
Yeah.
Any questions for Mr. Melcher on this bill? Thank you for your testimony. Please, Mr. Ritchie.
Co-chairs Gilliam, Cannon, representatives, my name is Dennis Ritchie, once again, Executive Director of Oregon Anglers. We're actually in favor of this bill. I wasn't aware of the other studies coming forth. We certainly don't need duplication. However, and I'm very familiar with this area. I've got a summer home up on the Little North Fork of the river, and there not only is a problem with the warm water, there's also a splash dam there to divert some of the water over to the other side, and there's a problem with smolt going over the little splash dam and causing mortality too. So I would think that would be part of the study, but we're in favor of that. Thank you.
Mr. Ritchie, I just wanted, for the benefit of Senator Girard, on the sign-up sheet it says that you are against this bill.
I checked the wrong box.
All right. But I was thinking it was because of Senator Girard's testimony. Weighed you right over.
Well, I hope I've made your day.
Okay. All right. If there are any questions for Mr. Ritchie, otherwise, thank you both for coming. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2876 and declare that the House Energy, Environment, and Water Committee is adjourned.
Mr.